importance of racism in our society. Join us in this important conversation this Thursday at 8 a.m. on Voices from the Edge.
Today's guest, Dr. Tali Sharrett, most of us believe we live in a place like Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average. Optimism about our children, our health, and our careers seems to be hardwired into our brain. Dr. Sharrett studies decision-making at University College London and has written a book about optimism. Dr. Sharrett, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
How do you measure something like optimism? It seems like it's kind of a arbitrary or kind of a personal thing.
Well, there's many ways to measure optimism. The good thing is that most of them diverge. You can start with the most simple, explicit, straightforward way, which is using a scale. It's the most common scale to use optimism. It's called LOTR. And it simply asks you questions such as, how do you agree with the sentence saying, I always expect the best? I don't expect negative things to happen to me. So those kinds of questions. But there's other ways to do it as well. You could actually ask people about specific events if they expect those events to happen and at what probability. For example, in a study that I did, I had subjects come in and I gave them different events that might happen to them in the next month. And I asked them to say what do they think the likelihood of these events were to happen, such as getting stuck in traffic, making a nice meal, burning your meal, going to a movie that you enjoy, that you don't enjoy, and then having them come back at the end of the month and tell me which events happened and which did not. So you can do this, you know, you can ask people, how much do you think you're going to make in 10 years? Do you think you're going to get divorced? Do you think you're going to have cancer or this or that illnesses? And then have them come back and see what happened and what did not happen. You can also ask for the likelihoods of those events and then compare them to the average likelihoods. So there's many ways to measure. And as I said, the nice thing is that most of them diverge. So if you're high on optimism using one test, you're usually high on optimism using the other test.
So what you found, it seems, is that most people are wildly optimistic. Well, not wildly optimistic, because there's a mildly optimistic and there's a wildly optimistic, and people behave very differently if they're one way or the other.
Yeah, so most people are mildly optimistic, so we're not crazy. Most people don't think we're, you know, they're going to win the lottery, although people do buy lottery tickets, but they do overestimate the likelihood of winning the lottery. So we don't think we're going to be the president, but we think we're going to be more successful in our career than warranted. We think our kids are going to be exceptionally talented. So most of us are mildly optimistic. According to most estimates, about 80% of the population are optimistic or have an optimism bias, which means they overestimate the likelihood of positive events happening in their life and underestimate the likelihood of negative events happening in their lives. And this is something that's been found way before I started my experiments, which mostly look at the science of optimism, how the brain generates optimism. And there's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies. All of them show the same thing. Most of us have an optimistic bias, although we're not really aware of it.
So this optimistic bias, is it a cultural thing, or do you find it in many different kinds of cultures?
So it seems not to be a cultural thing. People have found optimism in different countries. I myself have done experiments in the U.S., in the Middle East, in Europe. There isn't much difference across those countries. You find it in different genders, different races, in different age groups. So young individuals are optimistic, but older adults are optimistic as well.
So the fact that we get older, we get more experienced, doesn't kind of push that optimism away?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not fully understood yet. There's a study, there's not a lot of studies, I would say maybe two or three. So one study uses the most common measures of optimism, and what they find is that optimism does not decrease with age. If anything, it slightly increases in older adults, which I guess goes along a line with a lot of studies that showing that people are happier when they are getting to older age versus middle age.
Well, that kind of makes sense because you're life, your responsibilities are lessening. You've got more time to think about, you know, what you would like to do as opposed to having to devote all your time to what you have to do.
Yes, indeed. And happiness does not equal optimism. It's two different things, but they are related because optimistic people tend to be happier as well. And I think one of the reasons that optimistic people tend to be happier is because optimism brings you happiness. So if you expect positive events happening in your future, that makes you happier, and optimism is related to better well-being.
See, that kind of seems contradictory to me, or because, you know, the idea is that a pessimist is never disappointed. But if you're constantly expecting things to be better than they are, wouldn't you be constantly disappointed? And over time, wouldn't you start saying, well, I really am not going to win the lottery?
So that actually is point blank wrong. So I just read a very good review by two scientists called Marshall and Brown, where they actually look exactly at this. They say, well, you know, we know that optimists expect better things that they end up getting, so wouldn't they be disappointed, and therefore optimism is not good for us. And actually, William James, who's kind of the founder of psychology, suggested just that. He suggested in order to be happy, lower your expectations, you're never disappointed. Well, turns out it's not true. Any studies looking at whether high expectations make you less happy show that it's not true. There's many examples. So, for example, there's been a study looking at students just before they had a psychology exam, and they asked them, what is a grade that you expect? Then they took the exam, came back a few weeks later, got their grade. People who expected high grades but did not get them were as sad as people who expected low grades and did not get them. So the question is, why is that? Turns out that optimists are just happier, point blank. Optimism is good for our well-being. So there's two things that happen. When they get the negative grade, well, they reinterpret that event. So they say, well, okay, I got a negative, you know, I didn't get a good grade now, but I'll work harder next time. It doesn't mean that I'm stupid. And the people who tend to be pessimistic and expect negative events, when those happen to them, they don't reinterpret those events. They actually say, oh, no, I got a bad grade. That means that next time I'm going to get a bad grade, and it's all because, you know, I'm not good and so on. So it seems that those effects are stronger than the actual disappointment. So people are surprised. And to the contrary, being surprised when you expect something good and you don't get it is actually better for us. So there's a really clever study by a cognitive neuroscientist called Sarah Benston. And what she did, she had people come in and she primed them with either the words smart and clever or stupid. And then she gave them different tasks, cognitive tasks to do. What she found was that if people were primed with the word smart, when they committed an error, they were more surprised, of course. And what she found was that the activity in the frontal lobes, which is part of our brain, which is developed later in evolution, activity there was enhanced every time someone committed an error if they were primed with the word smart. So it's if the brain was saying, oh, no, you know, I didn't expect this, and there's something going on, and pay attention, I did an error. And they learned better because they expected to do well, they didn't, and so they learned from their errors. People who were primed with the word stupid, they didn't have enhanced activity in their frontal lobes when they committed an error, and therefore they didn't learn from it. And at the end of the day, they did worse.
So that idea that what you tell your children they are is hugely important, because if you keep telling them they're clever, they're going to become clever.
Yeah, I think the data definitely suggests that that's true, that expectations shape who we are. And our expectations are shaped also by others, right? So kids' expectations of themselves are shaped by what people tell them. And there's many many data and many evidence suggesting that optimism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you expect to do better, you're going to do better because you're going to commit the actions needed. For example, it's been shown that optimists earn more. So one point on the optimism scale, which measures trade optimism, earns you $32,000 more in annual salary. Now, why is that? So two economists at Duke found that optimists work longer hours and they work harder. The idea of if you expect to do well, if you expect to get ahead, you're going to put the effort in. If you don't, you're not going to put the effort in, and then you're not going to get there.
Now, one of the reasons for you studying this is to look at depression and the way that that affects people's lives and kind of the mechanisms of it. It was interesting in the book, apparently just changing the levels of things like serotonin changes a person's whole outlook, and the amount of optimism that they have then seems to be this kind of self-amplifying loop.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, people with mild depression are the realists. So they actually have more accurate estimation of what is going to happen in the future than healthy individuals. And people with severe depression, they have a pessimistic bias. So they expect things to be worse than they end up being. Which actually means that without an optimism bias, most of us will be at least mildly depressed. And depression, we feel it as a mood, as low mood, but it doesn't start out as low mood. It starts out as biases in our cognition. It's people with depression usually interpret events in a negative way. So they attend more. Their attention is more to negative faces, for example. If they see sad faces or fearful faces, their attention will be captured by those faces more than happy faces. And they will be their attention will be captured more by negative information. So, for example, we have shown in a recent study that healthy individuals learn more from desirable information about the future than undesirable. So, for example, if someone says, my likelihood of having cancer is 40%, and then we tell them the average likelihood is only 30%, it's not as high. Well, next time they would say, oh, you know what, maybe my likelihood of having cancer is lower, maybe it's just 33%. So they learn very quickly when we give them positive, unexpected information about the future. And if someone says, my likelihood of getting cancer is 10%, and we say, you know, the average likelihood is much worse, it's 30%. Well, next time around, they don't change their belief. They say, maybe it's 11%. I'm kind of sticking where I am. Depressed individuals do exactly the opposite. So they learn more from negative information about the future than from positive information about the future. And what that means is that they end up with a negative outlook on life and on the future. And that then creates a negative mood and, you know, a low mood, low affect.
And that idea is that they keep going out and picking out the negative information to keep reinforcing that negative worldview. But it seems like there's a chemical basis for it, because once you change the chemical structure of the brain, then they change what they're looking for.
Yes, indeed. So antidepressants will then change these cognitive biases. There's different antidepressants. Most of them are based on changing the levels of serotonin, but there's some antidepressants that also change the levels of dopamine. And both of these are important, and they're important for different mechanisms, slightly different mechanisms. We have seen that dopamine is specifically important for changing how much you learn from information about the future. But serotonin, for example, changes whether you attend to positive stimuli, such as happy faces versus sad faces. And that's what happens. When you give people antidepressants, their attentional biases are changed, and their mood is not changed immediately. But after a while, when they, you know, attend to these more positive events in life and to the positive information, after a while, that has an effect on their mood as well. And so their mood is enhanced.
I'm speaking with Dr. Tali Sharat. Her book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. She'll be speaking tonight at Powell's on Burnside at 7:30 p.m. with David Eagleman, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Now, I've heard a lot of information about studies showing that antidepressants are not really much more effective than placebos, but it sounds like from your work, that's not what you've seen at all.
Well, I have only done very little studies on antidepressants, only one piece of work, and it's not out. So it's basically based on other people's work. I think most of the studies will show that antidepressants have more of an effect than just a placebo. However, that's not true for everyone. So not everyone with depression can benefit from antidepressants. And some people benefit from specific ones, but not from other ones. And some people just don't benefit from antidepressants at all. So I think depression is kind of an umbrella for a lot of different disorders that are similar but also slightly different, and maybe the biological basis of depression is a little bit different in these groups. And so it can help, but not everyone. And then, you know, there's other treatments. You have cognitive therapy as well. And as we talked earlier between us, there's deep brain stimulation, which is a new form of treatment that hasn't been used a lot yet. It's much more invasive. So you really use that when everything else doesn't work. And that includes actually simulating a specific part of the brain to try and get people out of their episode of depression.
Right. And in the book, you have a description of this woman who undergoes this procedure, and it actually involves putting a hole in your skull and then putting a probe in and artificially stimulating part of the brains. But for her, it worked.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, after everything else doesn't work, that seems to be one option. Again, there's only a few studies out there, but it seems promising.
You'd have to be pretty desperate to want somebody to drill into your brain to be able to make you feel better.
Yeah, and I'm sure that these patients are, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. But it kind of points to us and our outlook on life and our moods and everything being extremely mechanistic. And from the inside, we feel like we're determining our own outlook on life. But from the work that you're doing, it sounds like we're really at the mercy of our hardware a lot more than we expect.
So I think there's a little bit of a confusion here. The fact that we are material, you know, we are our bodies, doesn't mean that we don't have an effect on our decisions. Because we are our brain, and our brain does make decisions, right? So I don't see a conflict between the two.
So it's not like we're completely controlled by the mechanisms of the brain, because not only are we controlling the mechanism, it's a mutual feedback thing. We're controlling the mechanisms of the brain, but the brain is also having its say mechanically of how we react.
Well, we are our brains, right? We are our brains, and therefore if our brain makes a decision, that means we make a decision. So it's just a matter of definition. But I think the idea that we don't have free will, that we don't make decisions, is very dangerous. I don't think that, I mean, in my view, that's not true. And also a thing to remember that our brain has a lot going on at any point of time, you know. There's a lot of different structures, and, you know, they're weighing in. If you're making a decision, there's a lot of different factors and a lot of different mechanisms going on, which kind of fight between themselves until, you know, a decision had been made. But we are all of that. We are all of those little parts of the brain that's trying to decide what to do next.
And this idea that we have this bias towards optimism, this isn't conscious on our part. We don't understand even that we're being optimistic.
Absolutely. So the optimism bias is just another example of the many illusions of the human brain. We are unaware of our optimistic bias. It's kind of a trick that our brain plays on us. And the trick plays, the brain plays a lot of tricks on us. It's not the only one. And people are not aware of those. The easiest ones to show people, because they're always like, well, no, I don't believe it. I'm a realist. I know what I expect, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of people will come into my lab and say, I'm a realist. And then I do the experiments and show them that they're as optimistic as anyone else. And in the book, I give some optical illusions, some visual illusions, where I show you that what you think is out there in the world, what you think you see, is actually a deception. It's our brain deceiving us for different reasons, and it's not the same. It's easier to show with optical illusions, because you kind of can move different parts and different, you know, change colors and show people that the illusion while it unfolds. And so they can believe that, even though that's difficult, they believe it. The same thing is with the optimism bias. I mean, you have to do more than just show them, you know, one kind of photo and change it a little bit, but you have to actually show them a lot of evidence. So, you know, you'd really have to read the book in order to, at the end, kind of say, yeah, you know what, you're probably right. And you have to do the science and you have to gather the data to actually show that there is a bias, that we're not aware of it.
And can that bias be dangerous? I'm thinking, for example, building a nuclear power plant and not expecting the 9.0 earthquake, where we wind up being optimistic about things that we shouldn't be optimistic about.
Yeah, so optimism has a lot of advantages. It's better for our health, it's better for our well-being, it's better for our careers and relationships, and lots of advantages. But there are disadvantages, as you say. So if we underestimate our risks, that means that we might not take the precautionary actions needed to protect ourselves. And it can be on an individual level. You know, you can say you might not go to medical screenings because you think you're going to be okay, not put sunscreen on you when you go to the beach, not buy insurance. People tend to underestimate how much things are going to cost them if you're renovating your house. People tend to not put enough money aside for it and think that they're going to be done before they are done. And then you have, you know, the optimistic bias that puts us into trouble on a government or world level, as you mentioned. And for example, the 2008 financial collapse, it's thought that one of the reasons for that was the optimism bias. So individuals and financial analysts and government officials all had an optimistic bias where they thought the economy will continue growing, and they failed to see the warnings. And there were some people who saw those warnings. There's an economist at NYU who kept saying, you know, this is not right, it's going to go down. But people don't want to listen to those negative forecasts, and they didn't, and so that happened. But the British government, for one, has already taken actions to protect itself, at least. In the Green Book, which is a book with recommendations for project appraisals, they say there's an optimism bias, and you have to adjust all budgets of the government for the optimistic bias. And the 2012 Olympics, which is going to be held in London, has already been adjusted for the optimistic bias. And it's one of the first Olympics which is on budget. So it hasn't gone over yet.
So that would be an interesting thing for just project management. Just assume that there's going to be an optimistic bias and then build in extra time and cost so that you understand that everybody's either that, or you make sure that you have depressives in all the decision-making offices.
Absolutely. And people, as I said, people do this already. This is kind of something that people start. Not everyone knows about it, but there is a kind of a beginning. And people are doing this in governments, in different companies, and you can do it on an individual level as well.
So how did you become interested in studying optimism?
So it was all quite an accident. I didn't mean to study optimism. What I was doing back in the day was I wanted to see whether the same structures that are involved in recollecting our past are also involved when we imagine the future. There was some evidence to suggest that the same neural mechanisms are involved in both tasks. And so I started an experiment where I had people come into my lab and I gave them different events that might happen to them in the next 5 years. And I asked them to either imagine those events happen or recall those events happening in the past. And at that point, something very interesting happened, which is even when I gave them very boring events, mundane events such as getting a haircut or going in a plane or riding a ferry, people imagined these magnificent scenarios around them. They imagined the best possible scenario every time. So, for example, for getting a haircut, a person said, oh, I imagine getting a haircut and donating my hair to Locks of Love, which is a charity, and then going to celebrate with all my friends. For a flight, someone said, oh, I imagine a very peaceful flight. I will sleep all the way and then get there in time and clap when the plane lands. Almost all of the volunteers did this. They had this kind of like magnificent scenarios, and that was very surprising to me. And that's where when I started being interested in optimism and the biases in how we imagine our future.
Now, does it seem like large events in people's lives change their optimism bias? Like if you have a very large negative, I was reading in the book where they can actually identify a genetic propensity towards, say, depression. But because it's there doesn't necessarily mean it's going to manifest. But then is it like a life event that then triggers the propensity that's already there?
Yeah, so a depression is an interaction between our genes, so what we are born with, but also what we experience in life. And what that study showed, which was published in Science, was they identified specific genes that are related to your, you know, likelihood of suffering from depression, but they found that your likelihood of suffering from depression is related to your genes, but also your experiencing stressful life events. And it's a combination of the two that makes you more likely to suffer from depression. On the other hand, if you have a different type of that gene that's more related to optimism, then even if you have these stressful life events, then you're still not very likely to go into depression. And what people do usually when they have very stressful life events, very negative events, they tend to quite surprisingly find the silver lining. So after the initial shock, let's say you lose your job or you get ill, after the initial shock, what people do, they try to figure out how to, you know, make things better. They might say, well, I lost my job, but I'm going to try and find a better one. Maybe I'd even go back to school. Maybe I'll go traveling for a bit. So they try to find the most positive reinterpretation of the event. And even illness, people do that. So if you look at Lance Armstrong, who suffered from cancer, he actually said that he values having cancer. He would not give that up because it made him into a better person and a better father.
That's really surprising. But it seems like it's this, it's again, it comes down to it's a combination of the mechanisms that we've inherited, but life experience. But there does seem to be a way that we can predict that some people, if they have a setback, are going to react badly to it, and other people are going to react well to it. And it almost kind of makes sense to be able to say, well, maybe we should screen for this so that we know that, you know, maybe these kids we treat a little bit differently than these other kids because we know that this is going to react badly with them.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of our goals. So although, as I said, there's you can screen for genes, that's still a little bit expensive and a little bit complicated. What we're thinking is maybe we can do these cognitive tests and use them to predict who's more likely or less likely to suffer from depression. And if we can do that, that can be very useful.
Well, but once you've identified it, it doesn't mean that that's a certainty. But, you know, would you just change the way people treat the kids or talk to the kids? Or do you immediately go to, like, a chemical solution?
Oh, no. I mean, I wouldn't go myself. I wouldn't recommend going to a chemical solution without a good reason. No, but what we would do first, we would have, I mean, this is going to be years, right? So first we'd have to do these tests and then wait for the kids to grow up and see whether we have actually a method that's, you know, has statistical significance, which can predict who's going to get depression and who's not. So that will be the first stage. After we do that, then we know we have a good method. Then you could do, you could again test the kids who are going to be kids at that time. And with that information, maybe be more aware or treat them with some kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm not quite sure. That's a bit further away from my field. I'm not a therapist. But at least you'd have some kind of identification.
Okay, absolutely fascinating. My guest today has been Dr. Tali Sharat, and her book is The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. She'll be speaking tonight, 7:30 at Powell's on Burnside. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the noontime jamboree. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
That's where I wanna be. That's where I'm gonna be.
Oh, yeah?
Way out west, just once again, where happiness is complete. There's one thing I miss, and it is this.
Oh, give me a horse, great big horse. Give me a buckaroo and let me wahoo, wahoo.